And we are burning down the house. Here every Thursday at 8 on heritageradionetwork.com. A continuing conversation about the culture of architecture in which we tear down, lay forth, and build up the elements, the attitudes, opinions, obsessions, fantasies, passions, and ideas that inform and direct the creation of our built environment. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, your host. Our sponsor is TechServe, your number one source in Manhattan, New York, for everything related to the Macintosh computer, and also for pro audio and high def monitors. It's a wonderful place, and I encourage you to pay them a visit on West 23rd Street. This evening, my theme, because post-Labor Day, everyone's so busy, which gave me an opportunity to share with you some tales of architecture, stories about architects renowned, fabled, and also unknown. In the times of the Renaissance, when architecture was not only an important undertaking, but was elevated to a high art, Giorgio Vasari, an architect himself, the architect of the Colonnade. If you have ever been to Florence, Firenze, at the end of the piazza that fronts the Uffizi galleries, which were the galleries of the Medici family, the merchant bankers who pretty much owned Florence in the early and middle 1500s. There's a colonnade that closes off the space, and Giorgio Vasari was the architect of that. And Vasari wrote The Lives of the Architects in and around 1550, in which he described in detail not only his understanding of the lives of the different artists and architects, sculptors, and poets of the Renaissance, but also his observations. Now, if we fast forward 450 years, give or take a few, there are architects renowned and unknown that I have had the great luck to know, and I want to share some of these stories with you. And the reason that I thought of doing this evening is that this spring I went to the student show at my alma mater, the Cooper Union for Art and Architecture, and I met many students in their 20s, and they had a burning interest in knowing something about the great near-history architects who had a major role in forming the educational and aesthetic movements that Cooper carries forth even to this day. John Haydick was one of the five architects. A seminal book that was published in the 1970s, architects who designed pristine geometric buildings, mostly white. The other four of the five architects were Richard Meyer, who's still practicing. There's many buildings in Manhattan that you can see, the Meyer Lofts along West Avenue, and before that, the Westbeth Studios. Peter Eisenman, who's still practicing and teaching. Michael Graves, who made a name for himself designing interesting objects for Target, the mass market store. And Charlie Guathmey, who passed away a few weeks ago, of whom we spoke about a month ago upon the circumstances of his passing. And of the five architects, I was greatly influenced and educated and got to know Haydick, and Eisenman very much in his theory classes, and to a lesser degree, Michael Graves. And they're very renowned architects. But not all architects who are renowned are necessarily the conveyors of the social contract, of the education, of the continuing culture of architecture. Indeed, when I was a young intern architect, as a summer job, I was introduced to and had an initial interview with an architect, Tom Smith, Thomas G. Smith, in Rumson, New Jersey. And those of you who are now into cycling will be perhaps amused to know that 35 years ago that I would have taken my 12-speed bicycle 8 or 10 miles from our house to meet Mr. Smith, because that's the way that I got around. Now it's a very cool thing to be cycling in the city, but I was an early adopter of cycling, and so I had my clamp-on shoes, I had the bicycle hat, and I rode over to Rumson, New Jersey, and I met this architect who needed a draftsman. In these days, you'd be a CAD operator. In those days, we worked on paper with pencil, or vellum with pencil. And I met this man at a very simple room, and it seemed to have been a converted chicken coop or some sort of industrial building. To the side were greenhouses, and bumblebees were flying through the air. And there were, he looked off to the side, and there were plants growing. And he greeted me very, very cordially, but he was wearing just a T-shirt, and he hadn't shaved. And I thought, oh man, this is a guy who really needs a draftsman, but he's kind of down and out. Well, we got along quite well. He seemed to be a well-spoken architect, and he hired me. And over time, actually, it was a very delightful experience. Every morning, I would get there around 8:30. His wife, Graziella, would come with steaming bowls of caffè latte. She was Italian. Coffee with cream and sugar. Actually steaming. And she would say, oh, yeah, you don't have a girlfriend. It's okay. God has a woman in mind for you. And I thought, well, that's a nice idea. But I learned a lot from Tom, because Tom took responsibility not only for how the projects that he had looked, but for all of the other aspects of construction, something that we've spoken about here a few weeks ago with the friends of this program, the Sharpless twins from Shop Architects, how it looks should be, as we all believe, a function of how it's put together. Now, with Tom Smith, he didn't leave anything to a consultant. We had one situation where this design needed, and this was residential construction, all wood framing, and there was a deck, and it was cantilevered, meaning it stuck out from the side of the building like a diving board. And he turned to me, and I had only just completed third-year architecture school, and I had very little structural engineering training so far. And he said, well, calculate this for what size joists do we need? And I said, wow. And he just quickly went through the calculations, and he said, I'm surprised you don't know how to do this. Well, I just started. You must know how to do these calculations, because it's important if you're going to be a complete architect. And he sized the pipes in the houses and the vents, and all aspects of construction were things that he took responsibility for. Whereas these days, many architects are focused on how things should look, and the technical aspects are relegated to consultants. But I took a very, I took note of this. Now, the way that the Smith family lived was very interesting. It seemed very strange and not threatening, but definitely different from my very white bread WASP family. In fact, the building that they were living in had been a potting shed as a pavilion in the back of a grand estate in Rumson, New Jersey. And at the end of this long, linear building in which Tom Smith had his architect's studio with many, many, many books, and off to the side there were greenhouses that had remained from the days of this grand estate. He had built a wing with many, many playrooms and bedrooms for his passel of daughters who were in and out all over the place. And at the end, there was one great hall, which there were tapestries, and there were hammer-headed beam trusses, which you can look up. It very ornate, a grand space. And that, along with the ritual of having Graziella present us with cafe latte every morning, gave me a lot to wonder about. You know, what is this? You know, I first met the guy, and he was just wearing a T-shirt. He hadn't shaved, but yet there's this majestic living room, and then there are these girls running in and out, and the family had a VW Beetle, and it was just plastered up with Grateful Dead stickers. And I thought, do the parents know what deadheads are like? I mean, do they have any idea? Because deadheads that I knew were very drug-tolerant people. But yet the family worked together. Now, all these years later, just last week, I was remembering Tom Smith. His brother was Tony Smith, who was a second-tier sculptor. Tony did black sculptures, much like the one that you would see in Astor Place here in Manhattan, or across the river here. We're presently here in Brooklyn, across in Manhattan, in Astor Place, adjacent to Cooper Union. A big black sculpture that looks like a Chinese puzzle that you have to pull or push. And Tony Smith did sculptures like that. Sort of if you took a cigarette pack and ran it over in two dimensions, the X and the Y, and then stood it on end and painted it black. Well, that's what Tony Smith sculptures were like. So I knew that Tom Smith, you know, had a brother who was an artist. But what I found out all these years later is that Tom and Graziella were good friends with Lee Krasner, Jackson Pollock, Willem de Kooning. In a word, they were part of that whole art movement. And the way that they lived, it was all about art. And so even though their world was sort of free form and that children were deadheads and they didn't seem to have a lot of money, they had ritual. And they had form in their lives. And they were happy. Who wouldn't be happy having an architect's studio where the bumblebees flew through? And in the summer, you smelled the flowers. And yet, at the same time, it wasn't about merely how things looked, but rather taking responsibility as a master architect of your entire environment. And to you, Tom Smith, I raise my glass. Rest in peace. Let's hear a little Sugar Magnolia.
Sugar Magnolia, blossoms blooming. It's all empty and I don't care.
So my baby down by the river,
wishing I'd to come up soon for air.
blossom, come on, under the willow. We can have high times if you look back. We can discover the wonders of nature,
growing in the rushes down by the riverside. She's got everything delightful. She's got everything I need. Takes the wheel when I'm seeing double. Pays my ticket when I speed.
She comes skimming through rays of violet. She can wait in a drop of dew. She don't come and I don't follow. Waits backstage while I sing to you. But she can dance a Cajun rhythm, jump like a widow's in four-wheel drive. She's a summer love in the spring, fall, and winter. She can make happy any man alive. Sugar Magnolia, ringing that bluebell, caught up in sunlight, going out singing, all walking in the sunshine. Come on, honey, come along with me.
She's got.
And this is Burning Down the House, your weekly conversation or monologue about the culture of architecture. Our program is produced by E.J. Dukoski, engineered by Jack Inslee. And our very good sponsor is TechServe, your number one source for everything related to the Macintosh computer. I can't tell you how much the Grateful Dead factored in my own architectural education. My second year roommate was a total deadhead, and my choice was love it or be miserable. So guess what? I came to love them. Change of thread, a renowned architect and educator. You'd never know that penguins could have such a fascination for architects. This is apropos of nothing other than one of the trick questions on the architect's architectural history exam is, who designed the penguin pool at the London Zoo? And the answer is the Tecton Group. Now, for the life of me, I couldn't tell you what the penguin pool at the London Zoo looked like, but I can tell you that because of the stories that my dean at Cooper Union, John Q. Haydick, frequently told about penguins and his own obsession with penguins, especially emperor penguins, and especially the emperor penguins at the Edinburgh Zoo, meant as a recurring theme, as a parable. For interested lay people, you will know John Haydick primarily as an educator, but also as a poet. He is perhaps the poet laureate of architecture of the 20th century, not because his poems are about architecture, but because he probably produced more works of poetry, certainly, than he did of theoretical works of architecture. In sum, his built works of architecture were very few. His theoretical works were manifest, and his poetry was even greater. But let's get back to the penguins. When Dean Haydick would be looking at and this is for you, the Cooper students, to a great degree, this is for you, my future fellow alums. These are things that I don't think that your current professors are sharing with you, and part of the heritage or mission statement of Heritage Radio Network is to accumulate oral history about our times. And I wanted to share this with you, lest this particular story and many of these stories be lost. If a student presented a project that was just not there, John Haydick would start talking about Walking with the Penguins. Now, at the Edinburgh Zoo in Edinburgh, Scotland, there is a ritual in which they have the penguins march with the visitors to the zoo, and they open the gates, and the emperor penguins march around for a few minutes, and then they return to their penguin enclosure. And for the greatest lot of time, after hearing what Dean Haydick had to say, I really wanted to go to Edinburgh and experience that. But as luck would have it, when I went to Edinburgh, I was accosted by a man who was dressed very elaborately. He looked like an admiral in the parking lot. My wife and I thought that we'd been accosted for the purpose of being given a summons because we'd somehow parked illegally. As it turned out, he was trying to sell us a subscription to the Royal Auto Society, the UK version of the AAA, and we missed the march of the Emperor Penguins. But this is what Dean Haydick had to say about his obsession with the penguins, is that he went to Edinburgh and he marched with the penguins, and it was a flat experience. They were just mindless beings in starched suits. And he would say that to people and to leave the room. That was his teaching style, to just throw off a non sequitur and leave. And you'd be left wondering, what did that mean? He's marched with me, the Emperor Penguin, and it was a flat experience. Not full of juice, not three-dimensional, a flat experience. And another thing about, tradition of Giorgio Vasari, and we should quote some of John Haydick's poetry. And after I graduated from Cooper Union, I kept in touch with my Cooper roots. Let me look for this here. As a touring dean promoting his poetry, he at one point found himself invited to present his work at the University of Chicago. And I'd returned from a trip from Chicago, where I was living at the time, back east, and got notice that he'd been in Chicago just the day before presenting his poetry. And I found out, I guess I called Cooper, and they told me where he was. And I found him at his hotel suite at the Drake Hotel. And I called him up and introduced myself. Of course, he remembered me. It'd only been a few years. I'd been one of his favorite students, not patting myself on the back, but he remembered. And he waxed so eloquently about the setting. And this was something very dear to Haydick's heart. The ambiance, the setting, which has everything to do with what we as architects and our social contract is with the world of creating a place, a time-constrained place, a setting. And he had read his poetry in the Ida Noyes Hall at University of Chicago. And they had prepared, because this is winter time, a roaring fire in front of which he had stood to recite his poetry. And he was so excited about the roaring fire and the flickering light on the walls of this neo-Gothic building at University of Chicago. And when he really was either provoked or excited and enthusiastic, he would revert to his Bronx roots, which he used to great effect to stupefy people. He would use his Bronx accent, you know, the days, deems, does, the verbal equivalent of the Bronx cheer in Yankee Stadium. And this is one of his poems. Orpheus's memory. She pleaded her case, and the fog amplified her cries. Her Tabis taught her how to float 1 inch above the ground. He placed his arm around her waist so she could feel her weight. The departure slipped through his fingers. Eurydice proceeded towards him, intent on his disappearance. He tried to capture the sound of her death memory. She tore apart the strings of his lyre. Her heart burst red roses. And that's the kind of poetry an architect would write. I don't know what to make of it myself. And I leave it to posterity to determine whether John Haydock, one of the great white architects, the five architects of lore, was more important as a poet of the late 20th century, or as an educator, or as an architectural theorist. And next, I want to talk about someone who was incredibly well connected with a source to the five architects, the five white architects of New York, someone who was involved with Le Corbusier, or Corbeau, as we often say. And let's have a little bit of an American in Paris, because that is important to what we're talking about next. After the end of World War II. Oh, this is Burning Down the House, sponsored by TechServe, your number one source for everything related to the Macintosh computer. And that was An American in Paris. But what I'm going to be speaking about is a Polish American in Paris. In 1949, after the end of World War II, a young man who had studied architecture in Warsaw and become a prisoner of war from the Polish army, Jerzy Sultan. We American kids who were students of his called him Jerzy, but it's J-E-R-Z-Y, Jerzy Sultan, who had the most remarkable experience of having been able to correspond with Corbu. I mean, that's just an astounding thing, that a prisoner of war could send a letter from a POW camp someplace in Nazi-occupied territory through the Nazi post to Paris and have correspondence with a French architect in Paris. Arrived in Paris and arrived on Corbu's studio doorstep saying, "Here I am," and became one of the most passionate acolytes of Le Corbusier, and took that experience then with him when he arrived in the United States 10 years later to begin conveying, teaching, sharing what he had learned from his time with the grand master of purist architecture, which is related to Cubism, the purist architecture of Corbu, Le Corbusier, whose real name was Charles Jeanneret Gris, but he took the nom de plume of Le Corbusier, the crow, in his writings in the 1920s, which had a great influence on the five architects, the five New York white architects, in whose work you see the Corbusian work taken further, which was their intended goal. And some of them did very well with that. Richard Meyer, for example, and Charles Guathmey in his first project, which we'll talk about later. And to a certain extent, Dean Hiddick, of whom I've just spoken. Sultan was a wonderful teacher. He was most passionate. And it's hard to synthesize or to distill exactly how he conveyed his ideas about what your own little student project might be. But he was most eloquent in a brutal sort of way if your project was no good. He would say in his Polish-inflected way, "This project looks to me like a broken brick." Or prick. "Oh, ouch," I would say. And I did. And in his way, he was a very good teacher of everything related to the experience that we would have from learning from Corbu. As you know, if you're an interested listener as a layperson, or if you've been in architecture school, Corbu tried to systematize or codify a progression of proportions that should be used in buildings. There is the knee-high height of, say, a hassock or an ottoman, and then there is the table height, and then there is the frequently overlooked standing on the mantelpiece height as you extend your arm and elbow and you're leaning. And then there is the full height of a person as you raise your hand up and you touch the top of the door. And he systematized, Corbeau did, all of these proportions according to the golden section of which we've previously spoken. The golden section is this Greek concept of the perfect set of proportions, a perfect rectangle. And if you take a rectangle that's generally 3 units by 5 units, or 5 units by 8, you superimpose that over an image of the Parthenon in Athens, the ancient Greek temple to Athena, the goddess of wisdom, you will see that the Greeks used this golden section again and again, wherever possible, because they believed, as many of us all these millennia later still believe, it is the most pleasing proportion. And what Corbeau did is that he worked all of these different proportions of the different heights of things which we encounter every day in our lives, in buildings, into a system. And interestingly enough, all of these proportions, the 3 to 5 to 8, also relate to this mathematical series called the Fibonacci series, Fibonacci. Signore Fibonacci in the 1200s derived this series of mathematical progressions based on the mathematics of the spiral of a seashell. Isn't that lovely? Isn't that wonderful? From nature to mathematics and back into the environment yet again. And Jerzy Soltan was very good at conveying to us this information. Now, the interesting thing about Corbeau and the modulor, which is what he called his system of proportions, is that it was based on people, mostly men, because we're talking about the 1920s, when women were, yes, emancipated, but not the focus of serious inquiry into architecture. And we'll leave that to a subsequent conversation about the subjugation of women to a secondary role in some subsequent program. But the proportions of men, French men, in the environment, in the built environment, then in the late 1940s, Corbeau came to America. He wrote about his experiences in a book that is translated into English called When the Cathedrals Were White. He was much taken with New York. He was much taken with the George Washington Bridge, which he saw as a rational expression of structure. Now, if you look at the George Washington Bridge, it seems rather pedestrian, and because it's all painted gray, it's almost invisible. But he took great solace in the clear expression of engineering principles in the design of the GWB. But he noted that Americans were taller, and indeed we tend to be taller. And so he had to create a new American modular, which was adjusted to American sizes. So there are two sets of modular, the red and the blue. Now, that modular definitely played a part in the work of the five architects. And, but before I leave Jerzy Soltan and move on to the other five architects, because he was a man of lusty temperament, he would have fit very well in the 19th century world, the lusty world of Balzac and Rodin. He told us one day that if, as young architects sometimes have the good fortune to find themselves at an Italian stone quarry, where it takes days and days and days to inspect slabs of stone, select them, reject them, because stone is a living material and flaws must be detected by looking at each slab before it goes and is fabricated and cut into pieces and then arrives and is put up in the hallways of your lobby or of an office building. Someone has to have the job of being at the quarry and accepting each piece of stone, which is a lengthy experience. You cannot rush Italian quarrymen. You cannot rush anything in Italy. But he said that the surest way to make yourself at home with Italian stonemasons was to pat a piece of stone and say the following, which I am not going to translate, but I will put the translation on my companion blog. He said, what you must say as you're patting a beautiful piece of stone is, acqua pura, pure water. Vino claro, clear wine. Ficca stretta, cazza d'oro. I'll leave you with that while we listen to something from the 1960s as a run-up to our little discussion of the five architects. And what, you may ask, here on the Burning Down the House, does White Rabbit have to do with the white architects, aside from the word white? Well, I'd like to put in context that this was the number one hit in 1967, The Summer of Love. And the greatest hits of the five architects date from 1967. And if you look at these pristine geometric works of architecture and put them in the context of Grace Slick, Wailing Feed Your Head, and the crazy guitar work of Jorma Kaukonen, it gives you a different overlay to the world that informed the creation of these pieces of architecture. And this is something that Philip Johnson spoke about frequently, about the Zeitgebundet, that's German, Z-E-I-T-G-E-B-U-N-D-E-T, Zeitgebundet, or locked in time nature of, for instance, Mies van der Rohe, or Walter Gropius, or for that matter, Hedick, Eisenman, Graves, Gwathmey, and Meyer. And what a wonderful thing it is that these crystalline geometric works of architecture were composed at the same time that we had popular music, like the Jefferson Airplane, but before the Grateful Dead. And we, you know, and this is something that some of you might want to do a master's or doctoral thesis on, the Zeitgebundet nature of architecture in its own time and popular music. I mean, the popular music that we heard from George Gershwin, American in Paris, has everything to do with the Jazz Age. These days, we have our friends of the show, Shop Architects. I don't know what music they listen to. When I visited their studio, it was very quiet. But we're in a time of many different tastes now and many different architectural expressions. But let me get back to telling tales of architects. And I want to tie it out in the 12 or 13 minutes that we have left. Peter Eisenman, one of the five, had been a senior designer, I believe, at the Architects Collaborative, the shop that Gropius established in Cambridge, Massachusetts, after he had to flee Germany when the Nazis had had enough of him and they closed down the Bauhaus. And Eisenman, in his early days, was very concerned with proving his former colleagues wrong, whom he called cartoonists. Truly. He wanted to have a more rational or organized system of rules by which to create architecture, much like Corbeau. Then Eisenman became enthralled with deconstructionist theory of Noam Chomsky and then later Jacques Derrida, D-E-R-R-I-D-A. A deconstructivist linguist. And what linguistics has to do with architecture, frankly, I am not in a position to have to explain to you, because frankly, I don't know. I mean, Hedick is opaque enough for me to ponder what Derrida has to do with architecture, frankly. You'll have to ask Peter Eisenman. But we must note these things in passing, because Peter Eisenman, in his early years, was wonderful as a lecturer, sharing everything that he had learned about form and volume and space, transparency and opacity. And he was a very good lecturer in the early years, when he was just beginning his career as an educator, when he approximately equal with the time that he founded the Institute for Architecture and Urban Studies, which prospered for a few years. And then there was Richard Meyer, who has done very well for himself, perfecting these forms of purist architecture over the years. Now, I never studied with Meyer. I would see him around at Cooper. And certainly I was aware of the Pre-Raphaelite beauty. Kate Gormley, a student at the Harvard Design School, who later became Mrs. Meyer. So I can certainly admire Mr. Meyer's taste in women, But I don't have anything to tell you about personal experiences of Richard Meier. And then there's Charlie Gwathmey. And yes, I would see Charlie around as a critic. And I sat in on some of his crits at the Yale School of Architecture late in his life when I was working just a few blocks away for Herb Newman in New Haven. But I did not know him. But I did have a very interesting experience with Michael Graves that I'd like to share, because I don't know what to make of it, except as a anecdote to the notion of social contract between we as older architects with you as younger architects. I was a student at the Harvard Design School, and we had been given a program to design, which was a multipurpose building for the Portuguese Heritage Foundation in Fall River, Massachusetts. And I had been up most of the night finishing my presentation, a model and many drawings. And I was still in the studio when the instructors arrived. And they said, Wayne, you present well, you'll go first. I said, oh, man, no, I've been up all night. I smell bad. I have to change my clothes. No, you're going to pin up first. And so I did. And Michael Graves was our visiting critic. He sat in the first row. The pizza has arrived. I'll have one piece, and you guys are going to have to finish the rest. This is like being in a real architect studio. People come in, they go out, there's interruptions. You need to understand that the life cycle of architectural design is very long. It takes a long time to design buildings. And on a day-to-day basis, an architect's studio is one of intermittent chaos. It's a fun place. Michael Graves sat in the front row. And he was resplendent in a silver sharkskin suit. We're talking 1976. The wide lapels. This is a little bit before the John Travolta era of the wide lapel white suit, but you have the same idea. In those days, young men wore their hair way over their ears, and Michael Graves, his wire-rimmed glasses, his total groovy hair, was sitting in the front row, and you know, in a student lecture chair with armrest that you could write on, busy sketching during my presentation, paying no attention. You can imagine, I think, perhaps, that since I'd been up most of the night and I was presenting and our guest critic was paying no attention whatsoever, that I began to become provoked. And then, because of this commission, this project that we were designing, involved in part a museum space, I had museum space with light coming from the top and opaque walls, and one of my classmates asked me why I didn't have windows. And I had the previous summer been in Venice on a grand tour. And I said, it's like this. When I was in Venice, there was this fabulous Tiepolo painting. Tiepolo being a Venetian painter who specialized in diaphanous putti and pink cotton candy clouds. This glow on the horizon, and all of this feathery stuff. And it's very nice stuff, Tiepolo. But it was in the museum called the Accademia on the Grand Canal. And they had windows open right to the canal and the Venetian sun. We're talking about the Adriatico, you know. There's a lot of sunlight in Italy, even northern Italy. Blasting in through this window next to the Tiepolo, and you know, your eyes could not adjust. I really couldn't see exactly what the Tiepolo was all about. And I said, I conveyed this little story. And then Michael Graves woke up. Oh, Tiepolo. Oh, well, he said, well, since you have the sensitivity, and I myself, formerly as a painter, I can understand that. But then he said, I don't understand how it is that your drawings aren't in proper presentation style. And you have to understand, if you look at the book Five Architects, you will see these pristine drawings, white Strathmore board, which is the most pure thing you will ever find on the planet. Crisp, heavy, white, on which it was expected in the Cooper Princeton, he was a teacher at Princeton, Cornell idiom of those years, that your presentation would be perfect and finished and clean and crisp and precise. But I'd been through that 5 years at Cooper, and my drawings were on Mylar ink, double-sided matte Mylar. It was clear, and you could write on the back with colored pencils and give them color. And I had text on the side with arrows that pointed at things, because I was trying to convey that this was a work in progress and to invite collaboration, and that the design was not complete, which was anathema to the point of view of this master of architecture at age 42 at that time. He was, his praises had been sung by Ada Louise Huxtable. And I think he broke down in the social contract there by expecting me to have presented in a formalistic kabuki style fashion without bothering to ask me what I was all about. Let's quickly have a little interesting Eamesian music, and I want to tell you a little story about Charles Eames and then tie out the evening. This is theme music to Charles Eames' The Power of Ten, a seminal movie that if you haven't seen it, you must find it. You can find it on the Eames Studio website. Charles Eames, architect of Santa Monica, California, whom I had the privilege to meet not but a few years before he passed away. I was an architecture student full of questions, so happy to meet finally Charles Eames, who was in New York to address a convention of architects at the old Commodore Hotel, which was where the Hyatt is next to Grand Central now. And I shook his hand, and I was so happy. I had all these questions, and he smiled. And you have to picture Charles Eames, 68 or so. You know, he's that period of that generation of architects who grew up during World War II, and he had a crew cut and skinny lapels, even though they were not the fashion in 1975, and he was wearing a bow tie, which was de rigueur for architects of a certain age. Frank Lloyd Wright always wore a bow tie. Gropius. Alvar Aalto, no. Eero Saarinen, no straight tie. But he was the epitome of an elder statesman of architecture, even though we know him mostly through his movies and his typography design for IBM, and his having designed the pavilion and all of the multimedia graphics for the IBM 1964-65 World's Fair Pavilion, and for having the innovated the multi-image presentation, which in those days was done with slide projectors, which we do with computers. But he was still a master architect. And I had all these questions, and he made his presentation, and he answered every one of my questions. He found me in the crowd, and he kept eye contact, and he answered all of my questions, which was a real thrill. But he concluded his presentation by telling a little story, a parable, perhaps. He said that when we have guests over to our house, meaning the Eames house, you know, that California case study house in Santa Monica that's in the grove of trees near the Pacific Ocean. We've looked at the pictures of that industrial structure, but with color and inlays of graphic images, and just full of a family's artwork. And their work was done there also in the early days. A kaleidoscope of artifacts for the family who still live there. The heirs to Ray and Charles Eames still live in that house. And he said, when we have friends over for cocktails, Ray will say to the ladies, come with me to the powder room, and perhaps you need to freshen up. And I will say to the men, what would you like to drink? And being an architect, said Mr. Eames, is like being a good host. It's all about accommodating your guests, or, as an architect, accommodating your client. What do they need? How can you help them? How is their life made better by what you have to offer? And, you know, looking back on this so many years later, the circle closes with my experience of Tom Smith, the architect of Rumson, New Jersey. Tom Smith and Charles Eames, one very famous and one totally forgotten except by his family, of course. They were both master architects. And Graziella bringing us the cafe latte in the morning. And Charles Eames talking about how do you accommodate your clients. The circle closes. And it gives me something to think about, lo, these many years later, about our social contract as architects and how we accommodate the world and make it a better place. Thank you for listening to Burning Down the House. Our sponsor has been TechServe, your number one source for everything related to the Macintosh computer, produced by E.J. Dukoski. Jack Inslee is our engineer, superlative, and we'll talk to you next time.